Day 6, 3:12 p.m. Everyone went to the window. We banged heads, trying to look out in all directions. As far as I could see, the horizon was clear. I saw nothing at all.
"Where are they?" I said.
"Coming from the south. We have them on the monitors."
"How many?" Charlie said.
"Four."
"Four?"
"Yeah, four."
The main building was south of us. There were no windows in the south wall of the shed. David said,
"We don't see anything. How fast are they coming?"
"Fast."
"Do we have time to run for it?"
"I don't think so."
David frowned. "He doesn't think so, Jesus." And before I could say anything, David had bolted for the far door, opened it, and stepped out into the sunlight. Through the rectangle of the open door, we saw him look to the south, shading his eyes with his hand. We all spoke at once.
"David! David, what the fuck are you doing?"
"David, you asshole!
I'm trying to see..."
"Get back here,
you stupid bastard!"
But Brooks remained where he was, hands over his eyes.
"I don't see anything yet," he said.
"And I don't hear anything. Listen, I think maybe we can make a run for..."
No, we can't."
He sprinted back inside, stumbled on the door frame, fell, scrambled to his feet, and slammed the door shut, pulled it tight behind him, tugging on the doorknob.
"Where are they?"
"Coming," he said. "They're coming."
His voice shook with tension.
"Oh, Jesus! They're coming!"
He pulled back on the doorknob with both hands, using his whole body weight. He muttered over and over,
"Coming! They're coming!"
"Oh, great," Charlie said. "The fucking guy's cracked."
I went over to David and put my hand on his shoulder. He was pulling on the doorknob, breathing in ragged gasps.
"David," I said quietly, "let's take it easy now. Let's take a deep breath."
I have to keep them.
He was sweating, his whole body tense, his shoulder shaking under my hand. It was pure panic.
"David," I said, "let's take a deep breath, okay?"
I have to.
"Big breath, David." I took one, demonstrating.
"That feels better. Come on now. Big breath."
David was nodding, trying to hear me. He took a short breath, then resumed his quick gasps.
"That's good, David. Now another one."
Another breath. His breathing slowed slightly. He stopped shaking.
"Okay, David, that's good."
Behind me, Charlie said,
"I always knew that guy was fucked up. Look at him, talking to him like a fucking baby."
I glanced back and shot Charlie a look. He just shrugged.
"Hey, I'm fucking right."
May said,
"It's not helping, Charlie."
"Fuck helping."
Rosie said,
"Charlie, just shut up for a while, okay?"
I turned back to David. I kept my voice even. "All right, David? That's good. Breathe. Okay, now, let go of the doorknob." David shook his head, refusing, but he seemed confused now, uncertain of what he was doing. He blinked his eyes rapidly. It was as if he was coming out of a trance. I said softly, "Let go of the doorknob. It's not doing any good." Finally, he let go and sat back on the ground. He began to cry, head in hands.
"Oh, Jesus," Charlie said. "That's all we need."
"Shut up, Charlie." Rosie went to the refrigerator and came back with a bottle of water. She gave it to David, who drank as he cried. She helped him to his feet, nodded to me that she'd take it from here. I went back to the center of the room, where the others were standing by the workstation screen. On the screen, the lines of code had been replaced by a monitor view of the north face of the main building. Four swarms were there, glinting silver as they moved up and down the length of the building.
"What are they doing?"
I said.
"Trying to get in."
I said, "Why do they do that?"
"We're not sure,"
May said. We watched for a moment, in silence.
Once again, I was struck by the purposefulness of their behavior. They reminded me of bears trying to break into a trailer to get food. They paused at every doorway and closed window, hovering there, moving up and down along the seals, until finally moving on to the next opening. I said, "And do they always try the doors like that?"
"Yes. Why?"
"Because it looks like they don't remember that the doors are sealed."
"No," Charlie said. "They don't remember. Because they don't have enough memory."
"Either that," he said, "or this is another generation."
"You mean these are new swarms since noon?"
"Yes."
I looked at my watch. "There's a new generation every 3 hours?" Charlie shrugged.
"I couldn't say. We never found where they reproduce. I'm just guessing."
The possibility that new generations were coming that fast meant that whatever evolutionary mechanism was built into the code was progressing fast, too. Ordinarily, genetic algorithms which modeled reproduction to arrive at solutions, ordinarily, they ran between 500 and 5,000 generations to arrive at an optimization. If these swarms were reproducing every 3 hours, it meant they had turned over something like 100 generations in the last 2 weeks. And with 100 generations, the behavior would be much sharper. May watched them on the monitor and said,
"At least they're staying by the main building. It seems like they don't know we're here."
"How would they know?" I said.
"They wouldn't," Charlie said. "Their main sensory modality is vision. They may have picked up a little auditory over the generations, but it's still primarily vision. If they don't see it, it doesn't exist for them."
Rosie came over with David. He said, "I'm really sorry, guys."
"No problem."
"It's okay, David."
"I don't know what happened. I just couldn't stand it."
Charlie said,
"Don't worry, David. We understand. You're a psycho and you cracked. We get the picture. No problem."
Rosie put her arm around David, who blew his nose loudly. She stared at the monitor.
"What's happening with them now?"
Rosie said. "They don't seem to know we're here."
"Okay.
We're hoping it stays that way."
"Uh-huh. And if it doesn't?"
Rosie said. "I have been thinking about that. If it doesn't, we rely on the holes in the pred-prey assumptions. We exploit the weaknesses in the programming."
"Which means?"
"We flock," I said. Charlie gave a hoarse laugh.
"Yeah, right. We flock. And prey like hell."
"I'm serious," I said. Over the last 30 years, scientists had studied predator-prey interactions in everything from the lion to the hyena to the warrior ant. There was now a much better understanding of how prey defended themselves. Animals like zebras and caribou didn't live in herds because they were sociable. Herding was a defense against predation. Large numbers of animals provided increased vigilance, and attacking predators were often confused when the herd fled in all directions. Sometimes they literally stopped cold. Show a predator too many moving targets, and it often chased none. The same thing was true of flocking birds and schooling fish. Those coordinated group movements made it harder for predators to pick out a single individual. Predators were drawn to attack an animal that was distinctive in some way. That was one reason why they attacked infants so often, not only because they were easier prey, but because they looked different. In the same way, predators killed more males than females because non-dominant males tended to hang on the outskirts of the herd, where they were more noticeable. In fact, 30 years ago, when Hans Kruk studied hyenas in the Serengeti, he found that putting paint on an animal guaranteed it would be killed in the next attack. That was the power of difference. So the message was simple. Stay together, stay the same.
That was our best chance. But I hoped it wouldn't come to that. The swarms disappeared for a while. They had gone around to the other side of the laboratory building. We waited tensely. Eventually, they reappeared. They once again moved along the side of the building, trying openings, one after another. We all watched the monitor. David Brooks was sweating profusely. He wiped his forehead with his sleeve. How long are they going to keep doing that?
As long as they fucking want, Charlie said.
May said, at least until the wind kicks up again, and it doesn't look like that's going to happen soon.
Jesus, David said.
I don't know how you guys can stand it.
He was pale, sweat had dripped from his eyebrows onto his glasses. He looked like he was going to pass out. I said, David, do you want to sit down?
Maybe I better.
Okay.
Come on, David,
Rosie said. She took him across the room to the sink and sat him on the floor. He hugged his knees, put his head down. She put cold water on a paper towel and placed it on the back of his neck. Her gestures were tender.
That fucking guy, Charlie said, shaking his head. That's all we need right now.
Charlie, May said, you're not helping.
So what? We're trapped in this fucking shed. It's not fucking airtight. There's nothing we can do, no place we can go, and he's fucking cracking up. Makes everything worse.
Yes, she said quietly. That's all true. And you're not helping it.
Charlie gave her a look and began to hum the theme from the Twilight Zone. Charlie, I said, pay attention. I was watching the swarms. Their behavior had subtly changed. They no longer stayed close to the building. Instead, they now moved in a zigzag pattern, away from the wall, into the desert, and then back again. They were all doing it, in a kind of fluid dance. May saw it too.
New behavior.
Yes, I said. Their strategy isn't working, so they're trying something else.
Not going to do shit for them, Charlie said. They can zigzag all they want. It won't open any doors.
Even so, I was fascinated to see this emergent behavior. The zigzags were becoming more exaggerated. The swarms were moving farther and farther away from the buildings. Their strategy was shifting progressively. It was evolving as we watched.
It's really amazing, I said. Little fuckers, Charlie said.
One of the swarms was now quite close to the rabbit carcass. It approached within a few yards and swirled away again, heading back to the main building. A thought occurred to me. How well do the swarms see? The headset clicked. It was Ricky.
They see fabulously, he said. It's what they were made to do, after all. Eyesight's 20/05, he said. Fantastic resolution. Better than any human.
I said, and how do they do the imaging? Because they were just a series of individual particles, like the rods and cones in the eye, central processing was required to form a picture from all the inputs. How was that processing accomplished? Ricky coughed.
Not sure,
Charlie said.
It showed up in later generations.
You mean they evolved vision on their own?
Yeah.
And we don't know how they do it.
No. We just know they just do.
We watched as the swarm angled away from the wall, moved back near the rabbit, then returned to the wall once more. The other swarms were farther down the building, doing the same thing, swirling out into the desert, then swirling back again. Over the headset, Ricky said,
why do you ask?
Because.
You think they'll find the rabbit?
I'm not worried about the rabbit, I said. Anyway, it looks like they already missed it.
Then what?
Uh-oh,
May said.
Shit, Charlie said.
and he gave a long sigh. We were looking at the nearest swarm, the one that had just bypassed the rabbit. That swarm had moved out into the desert again, perhaps 10 yards away from the rabbit, but instead of turning back in its usual pattern, it had paused in the desert. It didn't move, but the silvery column rose and fell. "Why is it doing that?" I said. "That up-and-down thing?"
"Something to do with imaging? Focusing?"
"No," I said. "I mean, why did it stop?"
"Program stall?"
I shook my head.
"I doubt it." "Then what?"
"I think it sees something."
"Like what?" Charlie said.
I was afraid I knew the answer. The swarm represented an extremely high-resolution camera combined with a distributed intelligence network. And one thing distributed networks did particularly well was detect patterns. That was why distributed network programs were used to recognize faces for security systems or to assemble the shattered fragments of archaeological pottery. The networks could find patterns in data better than the human eye.
"What patterns?" Charlie said when I told him. "There's nothing out there to detect except sand and cactus thorns."
May said,
"And footprints?"
"What, you mean our footprints from us walking over here? Shit, May, the sand's been blowing for the last 15 minutes. There's no footprints left to find."
We watched the swarm hang there, rising and falling like it was breathing. The cloud had turned mostly black now, with just an occasional glint of silver. It had remained at the same spot for 10 or 15 seconds, pulsing up and down. The other swarms were continuing in their zigzag course, but this one stayed where it was. Charlie bit his lip.
"You really think it sees something?"
"I don't know," I said.
"Maybe."
Suddenly the swarm rose up and began to move again, but it wasn't coming toward us. Instead, it moved on a diagonal over the desert, heading back toward the door in the power building. When it came to the door, it stopped and swirled in place.
"What the hell?" Charlie said.
I knew what it was. So did May.
"It just tracked us," she said. "Backward."
The swarm had followed the path we had originally taken from the door to the rabbit. The question was, what would it do next? The next 5 minutes were tense. The swarm retraced its path, going back to the rabbit. It swirled around the rabbit for a while, moving in slow semicircles back and forth. Then once again it retraced the route back to the power station door. It stayed at the door for a while, then returned to the rabbit. The swarm repeated this sequence 3 times. Meanwhile, the other swarms had continued their zigzagging around the building and were now out of sight. The solitary swarm returned to the door, then headed back to the rabbit again.
"It's stuck in a loop," Charlie said. "It just does the same thing over and over again."
"Lucky for us," I said. I was waiting to see if the swarm would modify its behavior. So far it hadn't, and if it had very little memory, then it might be like an Alzheimer's patient, unable to remember it had done all this before. Now it was going around the rabbit, moving in semicircles.
"Definitely stuck in a loop," Charlie said.
I waited. I hadn't been able to review all the changes they'd made to PredPrey, because the central module was missing. But the original program had a randomizing element built into it to handle situations exactly like this. Whenever PredPrey failed to attain its goal, and there were no specific environmental inputs to provoke new action, then its behavior was randomly modified. This was a well-known solution. For example, psychologists now believed a certain amount of random behavior was necessary for innovation.
You couldn't be creative without striking out in new directions, and those directions were likely to be random.
"Uh-oh,"
May said. The behavior had changed. The swarm moved in larger circles, going around and around the rabbit, and almost immediately it came across another path. It paused a moment, and then suddenly rose up and began to move directly toward us. It was following exactly the same path we had taken, walking to the shed.
"Shit," Charlie said. "I think we're fucked."
May and Charlie rushed across the room to look out the window. David and Rosie stood and peered out the window above the sink, and I started to shout, "No, no, get away from the windows."
"What?"
"It's visual, remember? Get away from the windows." There was no good place to hide in the storage room, not really. Rosie and David crawled under the sink. Charlie pushed in beside them, ignoring their protests. May slipped into the shadow of one corner of the room, easing herself into the space where the two shelves didn't quite meet. She could only be seen from the west window, and then not easily. The radio crackled.
"Hey, guys?"
It was Ricky.
"One's heading for you, and, no, two others are joining it."
"Ricky," I said, "go off air."
"What?"
"No more radio contact."
"Why?"
"Off, Ricky." I dropped down on my knees behind a cardboard carton of supplies in the main room. The carton wasn't large enough to hide me entirely. My feet stuck out. But like May, I wasn't easily seen. Someone outside would have to look at an angle through the north window to see me. In any case, it was the best I could do. From my crouched position, I could just see the others huddled beneath the sink. I couldn't see May at all, unless I really stuck my head around the corner of the carton. When I did, she looked quiet, composed. I ducked back and waited. I heard nothing but the hum of the air conditioner. 10 or 15 seconds passed. I could see the sunlight streaming in through the north window above the sink. It made a white rectangle on the floor to my left. My headset crackled.
"Why no contact?"
"Jesus fucking A," Charlie muttered. I put my finger to my lips and shook my head. "Ricky," I said, "don't these things have auditory capacity?"
"Sure, maybe a little, but be quiet and stay off."
"But..." I reached for the transmitter at my belt and clicked it off. I signaled the others beneath the sink. They each turned their transmitters off. Charlie mouthed something to me. I thought he mouthed,
"That fucking guy wants us killed."
But I couldn't be sure. We waited. It couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 minutes, but it seemed forever. My knees began to hurt on the hard concrete floor. Trying to get more comfortable, I shifted my position cautiously. By now I was sure the first swarm was in our vicinity. It hadn't appeared at the windows yet, and I wondered what was taking so long. Perhaps as it followed our path, it had paused to inspect the cars. I wondered what swarm intelligence would make of an automobile. How puzzling it must look to that high-resolution eye. But maybe because the cars were inanimate, the swarm would ignore them as some sort of large, brightly colored boulders. But still, what was taking so long? My knees hurt more with every passing second. I changed my position, putting weight on my hands and raising my knees like a runner at the blocks. I had a moment of temporary relief. I was so focused on my pain that I didn't notice at first that the glaring white rectangle on the floor was turning darker at the center and spreading out to the sides. In a moment, the entire rectangle turned dull gray. The swarm was here. I wasn't certain, but I fancied that beneath the hum of the air conditioner was a deep, thrumming sound. From my position behind the crate, I saw the window above the sink,
grow progressively darker from swirling black particles. It was as if there was a dust storm right outside. Inside the shed, it was dark, surprisingly dark. Underneath the sink, David Brooks began to moan. Charlie clapped his hand over his mouth. They looked upward, even though the sink blocked their view of the window above them. And then the swarm vanished from the window as quickly as it had come. Sunlight poured in again. Nobody moved. We waited. Moments later, the window in the west wall turned dark in the same way. I wondered why the swarm didn't enter. The window wasn't airtight. The nanoparticles could slide through the cracks without difficulty, but they didn't even seem to try. Perhaps this was an instance where network learning was on our side. Perhaps the swarms had been trained by their experience at the lab to think doors and windows were impermeable. Maybe that's why they weren't trying. The thought gave me a hopeful feeling that helped counteract the pain in my knees. The west window was still dark when the north window over the sink turned dark again. Now two swarms were looking in at the same time. Ricky had said there were three coming toward the building. He hadn't mentioned the fourth. I wondered where the third swarm was. A moment later, I knew. Like a silent black mist, nanoparticles began to come into the room underneath the west door. Soon more particles entered, all around the door frame. Inside the room, the particles appeared to spin and swirl aimlessly, but I knew they would self-organize in a few moments. Then at the north window, I saw more particles flooding through the cracks, through the air conditioning vents in the ceiling. Still more particles rushed downward. There was no point in waiting any longer. I got to my feet and stepped from my hiding place. I shouted for everybody to come out of hiding. Form up in two rows. Charlie grabbed the Windex spray bottle and fell into line, grumbling. What do you think our fucking chances are? The best they'll ever get, I said. Reynolds rules. Form up and stay with me. Let's go, now. If we weren't so frightened, we might have felt ridiculous, shuffling back and forth across the room in a tight cluster, trying to coordinate our movements, trying to imitate a flock of birds. My heart was pounding in my chest. I heard a roaring sound in my ears. It was hard to focus on our steps. I knew we were awkward, but we got better quickly. When we came to a wall, we wheeled and headed back again, moving in unison. I started swinging my arms and clapping with each step. The others did the same. It helped our coordination, and we each fought our terror. As May said later, it was step aerobics from hell. And all the time we watched the black nanoparticles as they came hissing into the room through cracks in doors and windows. It seemed to go on for a long time, but it was probably only 30 or 40 seconds. Soon a kind of undifferentiated fog filled the room. I felt pinpricks all over my body, and I was sure the others felt it too. David started moaning again, but Rosie was right beside him, encouraging him, urging him to keep it together. Suddenly, with shocking speed, the fog cleared, the particles coalescing into two fully formed columns that now stood directly before us, rising and falling in dark ripples. Seen this close, the swarms exuded an unmistakable sense of menace, almost malevolence. Their deep thrumming sound was clearly audible, but intermittently I heard an angry hiss, like a snake. But they did not attack us. Just as I had hoped, the programming deficits worked for us. Confronted by a cluster of coordinated prey, these predators were stymied. They did nothing at all, at least for now. Between claps, Charlie said, "Do you believe this fucking shit? It's working." I said, "Yes, but maybe not for long." I was worried about how long David could control his anxiety, and I was worried about the swarms. I didn't know how long they'd just stand there before they innovated new behavior. I said, I suggest we move toward that back door behind us and get the hell out. As we wheeled away from the wall, I angled slightly toward the rear room. Clapping and stepping in unison, our group moved away from the swarms, which thrummed deeply and followed.
And if we get outside, then what?
David whined. He was having trouble staying in sync with the rest of us. In his panic, he kept stumbling. He was sweating and blinking rapidly.
We continue this way, flocking this way, back to the lab, and get inside. Are you willing to try?
Oh, geez, he moaned. It's so far. I don't know if...
He stumbled again, nearly lost his balance, and he wasn't clapping with the rest of us. I can almost feel his terror, his overwhelming urge to flee.
David, you stay with us. If you go on your own, you'll never make it. Are you listening?
David moaned.
I don't know. Jack, I don't know if I can...
He stumbled again, bumped into Rosie, who fell against Charlie, who caught her and pulled her back to her feet. But our flock was knocked into momentary disarray, our coordination gone. Immediately, the swarms turned dense black, coiled and tightened, as if ready to spring. I heard Charlie whisper, "Oh, fuck," under his breath. And indeed, for a moment, I thought he was right and that it was all over. But then we regained our rhythm, and immediately the swarms rose up, returned to normal. Their dense blackness faded. They resumed their steady pulsing. They followed us into the next room, but they still didn't attack. We were now about 20 feet from the back door, the same door we had come in. I started to feel optimistic. For the first time, I thought it was possible we really might make it. And then, in an instant, everything went to hell. David Brooks bolted. We were well into the back room and about to work our way around the freestanding shelves in the center of the room, when he ran straight between the swarms and past them, heading for the far door. The swarms instantly spun and chased him. Rosie was screaming for him to come back, but David was focused on the door. The swarms pursued him with surprising speed. David had almost reached the door. His hand was reaching for the doorknob when one swarm sank low and spread itself across the floor ahead of him, turning it black. The moment David Brooks reached the black surface, his feet shot out from under him, as if he had stepped on ice. He howled in pain as he slammed onto the concrete, and immediately tried to scramble to his feet again, but he couldn't get up. He kept slipping and falling again and again. His eyeglasses shattered, the frames cut his nose. His lips were coated with swirling black residue. He started to have trouble breathing. Rosie was still screaming as the second swarm descended on David, and the black spread across his face, onto his eyes, into his hair. His movements became increasingly frantic. He moaned pitifully like an animal, yet somehow, as he slid and tumbled on hands and knees, he managed to make his way toward the door. At last, he lunged upward, grabbed the doorknob, and managed to pull himself to his knees. With a final desperate movement, he twisted the knob and kicked the door open as he fell. Hot sunlight flared into the shed, and the third swarm swirled in from outside. Rosie cried, "We've got to do something!" I grabbed her arm as she ran past me toward David. She struggled in my grip.
"We have to help him! We have to help him!"
"There's nothing we can do."
"We have to help him!"
"Rosie, there's nothing we can do." David was now rolling on the ground, black from head to toe. The third swarm had enveloped him. It was difficult to see through the dancing particles. It looked as though David's mouth was a dark hole, his eyeballs completely black. I thought he might be blind. His breath came in ragged gasps with little choking sounds. The swarm was flowing into his mouth like a black river. His body began to shudder. He clutched at his neck. His feet drummed on the floor. I was sure he was dying.
Come on, Jack, Charlie said. Let's get the fuck out of here.
You can't leave him, Rosie shouted. You can't, you can't!
David was sliding out the door into the sunlight. His movements were less vigorous now. His mouth was moving, but we heard only gasps. Rosie struggled to get free. Charlie grabbed her shoulder and said,
God damn it, Rosie!
Fuck you!
She wrenched free from his grip. She stamped on my foot, and in my moment of surprise I let go, and she sprinted across the shed into the next room, shouting,
David! David!
His hand, black as a miner's, stretched toward her. She grabbed his wrist, and in the same moment she fell, slipping on the black floor just as he had done. She kept saying his name until she began to cough, and a black rim appeared on her lips. Charlie said,
Let's go, for Christ's sake, I can't watch.
I felt unable to move my feet, unable to leave. I turned to May. Tears were running down her cheeks. She said,
Go.
Rosie was still calling out David's name as she hugged him, pulled his body to her chest, but he didn't seem to be moving on his own anymore. Charlie leaned close to me and said,
It's not your fucking fault.
I nodded slowly. I knew what he was saying was true.
Hell, this is your first day on the job.
Charlie reached down to my belt, flicked my headset on.
Let's go.
I turned toward the door behind me, and we went outside. Day 6, 4:12 p.m. Beneath the corrugated roof, the air was hot and still. The line of cars stretched away from us. I heard the whir of a video camera motor up by the roof. Ricky must have seen us coming out on the monitors. Static hissed in my headset. Ricky said,
What the hell's going on?
Nothing good, I said. Beyond the line of shade, the afternoon sun was still bright.
Where are the others? Ricky said. Is everybody okay?
No, everybody is not.
Well, tell me, not now.
In retrospect, we were all numb from what had happened. We didn't have any reaction except to try to get to safety. The lab building stood across the desert 100 yards to our right. We could reach the power station door in 30 or 40 seconds. We set off toward it at a brisk jog. Ricky was still talking, but we didn't answer him. We were all thinking about the same thing. In another half a minute, we would reach the door in safety. But we had forgotten the fourth swarm.
Oh, fuck, Charlie said.
The fourth swarm swirled out from the side of the lab building and started straight toward us. We stopped, confused.
What do we do? May said. Flock?
No. I shook my head. There's only three of us. We were too small a group to confuse a predator, but I couldn't think of any other strategy to try. All the predator-prey studies I had ever read began to play back in my head. Those studies agreed on one thing. Whether you modeled warrior ants or Serengeti lions, the studies confirmed one major dynamic. Left to their own devices, predators would kill all the prey until none remained, unless there was a prey refuge. In real life, the prey refuge might be a nest in a tree, or an underground den, or a deep pool in a river. If the prey had a refuge, they'd survive. Without a refuge, the predators would kill them all.
I think we're fucked, Charlie said.
We needed a refuge. The swarm was bearing down on us. I could almost feel the pinpricks on my skin and taste the dry, ashen taste in my mouth. We had to find some kind of shelter before the swarm reached us. I turned full circle, looking in all directions, but there was nothing I could see except...
Are the cars locked?
My headset crackled.
No, they shouldn't be.
We turned and ran. The nearest car was a blue Ford sedan. I opened the driver's door, and May opened the passenger side. The swarm was right behind us. I could hear the thrumming sound as I slammed the door shut, as May slammed hers. Charlie, still holding the Windex spray, was trying to open the rear passenger door, but it was locked. May twisted in the seat to unlock the door, but Charlie had already turned to the next car, a Land Cruiser, and climbed inside and slammed the door.
"Yow!" he said. "Fucking hot!"
"I know," I said. The inside of the car was like an oven. May and I were both sweating. The swarm rushed past us and swirled over the front windshield, pulsating, shifting back and forth. Over the headset, a panicked Ricky said,
"Guys, where are you? Guys?"
"We're in the cars."
"Which cars?"
"What fucking difference does it make?" Charlie said.
"We're in two of the fucking cars, Ricky."
The black swarm moved away from our sedan over to the Toyota. We watched as it slid from one window to another, trying to get in. Charlie grinned at me through the glass.
"It's not like the shed. These cars are airtight, so fuck 'em."
"What about the air vents?" I said.
"I shut mine."
"But they aren't airtight, are they?"
"No," he said. "But you'd have to go under the hood to begin to get in, or maybe through the trunk. And I'm betting this overbred buzzball can't figure that out."
Inside our car, May was snapping closed the dashboard air ducts one after another. She opened the glove compartment, glanced inside, shut it again. I said, "You find any keys?" She shook her head no. Over the headset, Ricky said,
"Guys, you got more company."
I turned to see two additional swarms coming around the shed. They immediately swirled over our car, front and back. I felt like we were in a dust storm. I looked at May. She was sitting very still, stony-faced, just watching. The two new clouds finished circling the car, then came to the front. One was positioned just outside May's passenger door window. It pulsed, glinting silver. The other was on the hood of the car, moving back and forth from May to me. From time to time, it would rush the windshield and disperse itself over the glass. Then it would coalesce again, back away down the hood, and rush again. Charlie cackled gleefully.
"Trying to get in! I told you they can't do it!"
I wasn't so sure. I noticed that with each charge, the swarm would move farther back down the hood, taking a longer run. Soon it would back itself up to the front grill, and if it started inspecting the grill, it could find the opening to the air vents, and then it would be over. May was rummaging in the utility compartment between the seats. She came up with a roll of tape and a box of plastic sandwich baggies. She said, "Maybe we can tape the vents." I shook my head. "There's no point," I said. "They're nanoparticles. They're small enough to pass right through a membrane."
"You mean they come through the plastic?"
"Or around through small cracks. You can't seal it well enough to keep them out."
"Then we just sit here?"
"Basically, yes."
"And hope they don't figure it out."
I nodded. "That's right." Over the headset, Bobby Lembeck said,
"Wind's starting to pick up again, 6 knots.
It sounded like he was trying to be encouraging, but 6 knots wasn't anywhere near enough force. The swarms outside the windshield moved effortlessly around the car. Charlie said,
"Jack, I just lost my buzzball. Where is it?"
I looked over at Charlie's car and saw that the third swarm had slid down to the front tire well, where it was swirling in circles and moving in and out through the holes in the hubcap.
"Checking your hubcaps, Charlie," I said.
He sounded unhappy, and with good reason. If the swarm started exploring the car thoroughly, it might stumble on a way in. He said,
"I guess the question is,
How big is their SO component, really?
That's right, I said.
May said,
In English?
I explained. The swarms had no leader and no central intelligence. Their intelligence was the sum of the individual particles. Those particles self-organized into a swarm, and their self-organizing tendency had unpredictable results. You really didn't know what they would do. The swarms might continue to be ineffective as they were now. They might come upon the solution by chance, or they might start searching in an organized way. But they hadn't done that so far. My clothes were heavy, soaked in sweat. Sweat was dripping from my nose and chin. I wiped my forehead with the back of my arm. I looked at May. She was sweating, too.
Ricky said, Hey, Jack.
What?
Julia called a while ago. She's checked out of the hospital, and
not now, Ricky.
She's coming out here tonight.
We'll talk later, Ricky.
I just thought you'd want to know.
Jesus, Charlie said, exploding. Somebody tell this asshole to shut up. We're busy.
Bobby Lembeck said,
8 knots of wind now. No, sorry, 7.
Charlie said,
Jesus, the suspense is killing me. Where's my swarm now, Jack?
Under the car, I can't see what it's doing. No, wait, it's coming up behind you, Charlie. Looks like it's checking out your taillights.
Some kind of car freak, he said.
Well, it can check away.
I was looking over my shoulder at Charlie's swarm when May said,
Jack, look.
The swarm outside her window on the passenger side had changed. It was almost entirely silver now, shimmering, but pretty stable, and on the silver surface I saw May's head and shoulders reflected back. The reflection wasn't perfect because her eyes and mouth were slightly blurred, but basically it was accurate. I frowned. It's a mirror.
No, she said. It's not.
She turned away from the window to look at me. Her image on the silver surface did not change. The face continued to stare into the car. Then, after a moment or two, the image shivered, dissolved, and reformed to show the back of her head.
What does that mean?
May said. I've got a pretty good idea, but the swarm on the front hood was doing the same thing, except that its silvered surface showed the two of us sitting side by side in the car, looking very frightened. Again, the image was somewhat blurred, and now it was clear to me that the swarm was not a literal mirror. The swarm itself was generating the image by the precise positioning of individual particles, which meant...
Bad news, Charlie said.
I know, I said. They're innovating.
What do you figure? Is it one of the presets?
Basically, yes. I assume it's imitation. May shook her head, not understanding. The program presets certain strategies to help attain goals. The strategies model what real predators do. So, one preset strategy is to freeze where you are and wait to ambush. Another is to random walk until you stumble on your prey, and then pursue. A third is to camouflage yourself by taking on some element of the environment so you blend in. And a fourth is to mimic the prey's behavior, to imitate it. She said,
You think this is imitation?
I think this is a form of imitation, yes.
It's trying to make itself appear like us?
Yes.
This is emergent behavior? It's evolved on its own?
Yes, I said.
Bad news, Charlie said mournfully. Bad, bad news.
Sitting in the car, I started to get angry, because what the mirror imaging meant to me
was that I didn't know the real structure of the nanoparticles. I'd been told there was a piezo wafer that would reflect light, so it wasn't surprising that the swarm occasionally flashed silver in the sun. That didn't call for sophisticated orientation of the particles. In fact, you would expect that sort of silvery ripple as a random effect, just the way heavily trafficked highways will clog up and then flow freely again. The congestion was caused by random speed changes from one or two motorists, but the effect rippled down the entire highway. The same would be true of the swarms. A chance effect would pass like a wave down the swarm, and that's what we had seen. But this mirroring behavior was something entirely different. The swarms were now producing images in color and holding them fairly stable. Such complexity wasn't possible from the simple nanoparticle I'd been shown. I doubted you could generate a full spectrum from a silver layer. It was theoretically possible that the silver could be precisely tilted to produce prismatic colors, but that implied enormous sophistication of movement. It was more logical to imagine that the particles had another method to create colors, and that meant I hadn't been told the truth about the particles either. Ricky had lied to me yet again, so I was angry. I had already concluded something was wrong with Ricky, and in retrospect, the problem lay with me, not him. Even after the debacle in the storage shed, I still failed to grasp that the swarms were evolving faster than our ability to keep pace with them. I should have realized what I was up against when the swarms demonstrated the new strategy, making the floor slippery to disable their prey and to move them. Among ants, that would be called collective transport. The phenomenon was well known. But for these swarms, it was unprecedented, newly evolved behavior. Yet at the time, I was too horrified to recognize its true significance. Now, sitting in the hot car, it wasn't useful to blame Ricky, but I was scared and tired, and I wasn't thinking clearly.
Jack?
May nudged my shoulder and pointed to Charlie's car. Her face was grim. The swarm, by the taillight of Charlie's car, was now a black stream that curved high in the air and then disappeared in the seam where the red plastic joined the metal. Over the headset, I said, "Hey, Charlie, I think it's found a way."
"Yeah, I see it." "Fuck a duck."
Charlie was scrambling into the back seat. Already, particles were beginning to fill the inside of the car, making a gray fog that rapidly darkened. Charlie coughed. I couldn't see what he was doing. He was down below the window. He coughed again.
"Charlie?"
He didn't answer, but I heard him swearing.
"Charlie, you better get out." "Fuck these guys."
And then there was an odd sound, which at first I couldn't place. I turned to May, who was pressing her headset to her ear. It was a strange, rhythmic rasping. She looked at me questioningly.
"Charlie?" "I'm spring, these little bastards. Let's see how they do when they're wet."
May said,
"You're spraying the isotope?"
He didn't answer. But a moment later, he appeared in the window again, spraying in all directions with the Windex bottle. Liquid streaked across the glass and dripped down. The interior of the car was growing darker as more and more particles entered. Soon, we couldn't see him at all. His hand emerged from the black, pressed against the glass, then disappeared again. He was coughing continuously, a dry cough.
"Charlie," I said, "run for it." "Ah, fuck. What's the point?"
Bobby Lembeck said,
"Wind's 10 knots. Go for it."
10 knots wasn't enough, but it was better than nothing.
"Charlie? You here?"
We heard his voice from the black interior.
"Yeah. Okay. I'm looking. Can't find... Fucking door handle can't feel. Where's the goddamn door handle on this..."
He broke into a spasm of coughing. Over the headset,
I heard voices inside the lab, all speaking rapidly. Ricky said, "He's in the Toyota. Where's the handle in the Toyota?" Bobby Lundbeck, "I don't know. It's not my car." "Whose car is it? Vince?"
"Vince."
"No, no. It's that guy with the bad eyes."
"Who?"
"The engineer, the guy who blinks all the time."
"David Brooks?"
"Yeah, him."
Ricky said, "Guys, we think it's David's car."
I said, "That's not going to do us any." And then I broke off, because May was pointing behind her to the back seat of our car. From the seam where the seat cushion met the back, particles were hissing into the car like black smoke. I looked closer and saw a blanket on the floor of the back seat. May saw it too, and threw herself bodily into the back, diving between the seats. She kicked me in the head as she went, but she had the blanket and began stuffing it into the crack. My headset came off and caught on the steering wheel as I tried to climb back to help her. It was cramped in the car. I heard a tinny voice from the earpieces.
"Come on,"
May said.
"Come on."
I was bigger than she was. There wasn't room for me back there. My body jackknife over the driver's seat as I grabbed the blanket and helped her stuff it. I was vaguely aware that the passenger door banged open on the Toyota, and I saw Charlie's foot emerge from the black. He was going to try his luck outside. Maybe we should, too, I thought, as I helped her with the blanket. The blanket wouldn't do any good. It was just a delaying tactic. Already, I sensed the particles were sifting right through the cloth. The car was continuing to fill. The air was getting darker and darker. I felt the pinpricks all over my skin. "May, let's run." She didn't answer. She just kept pushing the blanket harder into the cracks. Probably she knew we'd never make it if we went outside. The swarms would run us down, get in our path, make us slip and fall, and once we fell, they would suffocate us, just as they did to the others. The air was thicker. I started to cough. In the semi-darkness, I kept hearing a tinny voice from the headsets. I couldn't tell where it was coming from. May's headset had fallen off, too, and I thought I had seen it on the front seat, but now it was becoming too dark to see. My eyes burned. I coughed continuously. May was coughing, too. I didn't know if she was still stuffing the blanket. She was just a shadow in the fog. I squeezed my eyes against the sharp pain. My throat was tightening, and my cough was dry. I felt dizzy again. I knew we couldn't survive more than a minute or so, perhaps less. I looked back at May, but couldn't see her. I heard her coughing. I waved my hand, trying to clear the fog so I could see her. It didn't work. I waved my hand in front of the windshield, and it cleared momentarily. Despite my fit of coughing, I saw the lab in the distance. The sun was shining. Everything looked normal. It was infuriating that it should appear so normal and peaceful, while we coughed ourselves to death. I couldn't see what happened to Charlie. He wasn't in front of me anywhere. In fact, I waved my hand again. All I saw was blowing sand. Jesus! Blowing sand! The wind was back up.
"May!"
I coughed.
"May! The door!"
I don't know if she heard me. She was coughing hard. I reached for the driver's side door, fumbling for the handle. I felt confused and disoriented. I was coughing continuously. I touched hot metal, jerked it down. The door swung open beside me. Hot desert air rushed in, swirling the fog. The wind had definitely come up.
"May!"
She was racked with coughing. Perhaps she couldn't move. I lunged for the passenger door opposite me. My ribs banged on the gear shift. The fog was thinner now, and I saw the handle, twisted it, and shoved the door open. It banged shut in the wind. I pushed forward, twisted, shoved it open again, holding it open with my hand. Wind blew through the car. The black cloud vanished in a few seconds. The back seat was still dark. I crawled forward, out the passenger door, and opened the back door. She reached to me, and I hauled her out. We were both coughing hard. Her legs buckled. I threw her arm over my shoulder and half-carried her out into the open desert. Even now, I don't know how I made it back to the laboratory building.
The swarms had vanished. The wind was blowing hard. May was a dead weight on my shoulders, her body limp, her feet dragging over the sand. I had no energy. I was racked with spasms of coughing, which often forced me to stop. I couldn't get my breath. I was dizzy, disoriented. The glare of the sun had a greenish tinge, and I saw spots before my eyes. May was coughing weakly, her breath shallow. I had the feeling she wouldn't survive. I trudged on, putting one foot ahead of the other. Somehow, the door loomed in front of me, and I got it open. I brought May into the black outer room. On the other side of the glass airlock, Ricky and Bobby Lembeck were waiting. They were cheering us on, but I couldn't hear them. My headset was back in the car. The airlock doors hissed open, and I got May inside. She managed to stand, though she was doubled over, coughing. I stepped away. The wind began to blow her clean. I leaned against the wall, out of breath, dizzy. I thought, haven't I done this before? I looked at my watch. It was just 3 hours since I had narrowly escaped the last attack. I bent over and put my hands on my knees. I stared at the floor and waited for the airlock to become free. I glanced over at Ricky and Bobby. They were yelling, pointing to their ears. I shook my head. Couldn't they see I didn't have a headset? I said, "Where's Charlie?" They answered, but I couldn't hear them. "Did he make it? Where's Charlie?" I winced at the harsh electronic squeal, and then, over the intercom, Ricky said, "Not much you can do." "Is he here?" I said. "Did he make it?" "No." "Where is he?" "Back at the car," Ricky said. "He never got out of the car, didn't you know?" "I was busy," I said. "So he's back there?" "Yeah." "Is he dead?" "No, no, he's alive." I was still breathing hard, still dizzy. "What?" "Hard to tell on the video monitor, but it looks like he's alive." "Then why the fuck don't you guys go get him?" Ricky's voice was calm. "We can't, Jack. We have to take care of May." "Someone here could go." "We don't have anyone to spare." "I can't go," I said. "I'm in no shape to go." "Of course not," Ricky said, turning on his soothing voice, the undertaker's voice. "All this must be a terrible shock to you, Jack, all you've gone through."
"Just tell me, who's going to get him, Ricky?"
"To be brutally honest," Ricky said, "I don't think there's any point. He had a convulsion, a bad one. I don't think he has much left."
I said, "Nobody's going?"
"I'm afraid there's no point, Jack." Inside the airlock, Bobby was helping May out and leading her down the corridor. Ricky was standing there, watching me through the glass.
"Your turn, Jack. Come on in."
I didn't move. I stayed leaning against the wall. I said,
"Somebody has to go get him."
"Not right now. The wind isn't stable, Jack. It'll fall again any minute."
"But he's alive."
"Not for long."
"Somebody has to go," I said.
"Jack, you know as well as I do what we're up against," Ricky said. He was doing the voice of reason now, calm and logical. "We've had terrible losses. We can't risk anybody else. By the time somebody gets to Charlie, he'll be dead. He may be dead already. Come on and get in the airlock." I was taking stock of my body, feeling my breathing, my chest, my deep fatigue. I couldn't go back out right now, not in the condition I was in. So I got into the airlock. With a roar, the blowers flattened my hair, fluttered my clothes, and cleaned the black particles from my clothes and skin. My vision improved almost immediately. I breathed easier. Now they were blowing upward. I held out my hand and saw it turn from black to pale gray
then to normal flesh color again. Now the blowers came from the sides. I took a deep breath. The pinpricks were no longer so painful on my skin. Either I was feeling them less, or they were being blown off my skin. My head cleared a little. I took another breath. I didn't feel good, but I felt better. The glass doors opened. Ricky held out his arms. Jack, thank God you're safe. I didn't answer him. I just turned around and went back the way I had come. Jack? The glass doors whished shut and locked with a thunk. I'm not leaving him out there, I said.
What are you going to do? You can't carry him. He's too big. What are you going to do?
I don't know, but I'm not leaving him behind, Ricky. And I went back outside. Of course, I was doing exactly what Ricky wanted, exactly what he expected me to do. But I didn't realize it at the time. And even if somebody had told me, I wouldn't have credited Ricky with that degree of psychological sophistication. Ricky was pretty obvious in the way he managed people. But this time, he got me. Day 6, 4:22 p.m. The wind was blowing briskly. There was no sign of the swarms, and I crossed to the shed without incident. I didn't have a headset, so I was spared Ricky's commentary. The back passenger door of the Toyota was open. I found Charlie lying on his back, motionless. It took me a moment to see he was still breathing, although shallowly. With an effort, I managed to pull him into a sitting position. He stared at me with dull eyes. His lips were blue, and his skin was chalky gray. A tear ran down his cheek. His mouth moved. "Don't try to talk," I said. "Save your energy." Grunting, I pulled him over to the edge of the seat by the door and swung his legs around so he was facing out. Charlie was a big guy, 6 feet tall, and at least 20 pounds heavier than I was. I knew I couldn't carry him back, but behind the back seat of the Toyota, I saw the fat tires of a dirt bike. That might work. "Charlie, can you hear me?" An almost imperceptible nod. "Can you stand up?" Nothing, no reaction. He wasn't looking at me, he was staring into space. "Charlie," I said, "do you think you can stand?" He nodded again, then straightened his body so he slid off the seat and landed on the ground. He stood shakily for a moment, his legs trembling, and then he collapsed against me, clutching me to hold himself up. I sagged under his weight.
"Okay, Charlie."
I eased him back to the car and sat him down on the running board. "Just stay there, okay?" I let go of him, and he remained sitting. He still stared into space, unfocused. "I'll be right back." I went around to the back of the Land Cruiser and popped the trunk. There was a dirt bike, all right. The cleanest dirt bike I had ever seen. It was encased in a heavy Mylar bag, and it had been wiped down after it was used. That would be David's way, I thought. He was always so clean, so organized. I pulled the bike out of the car and set it on the ground. There was no key in the ignition. I went to the front of the Toyota and opened the passenger door. The front seats were spotless and carefully ordered. David had one of those suction cup notepads on the dashboard, a cradle for his cell phone, and a telephone headset mounted on a little hook. I opened his glove box and saw that the interior was neatly arranged, too. Registration papers in an envelope, beneath a small plastic tray divided into compartments containing lip balm, Kleenex, Band-Aids. No keys. Then I noticed that between the seats there was a storage box for the CD player, and beneath it was a locked tray. It had the same kind of lock as the ignition. It probably opened with the ignition key. I banged the tray with the heel of my hand and heard something metallic rattle inside.
It might have been a small key, like a dirt bike key. Anyway, something metal. Where were David's keys? I wondered if Vince had taken David's keys away on arrival, as he had taken mine. If so, then the keys were in the lab. That wouldn't do me any good. I looked toward the lab building, wondering if I should go back to get them. That was when I noticed that the wind was blowing less strongly. There was still a layer of sand blowing along the ground, but it was less vigorous. Great, I thought. That's all I need now. Feeling new urgency, I decided to give up on the dirt bike and its missing key. Perhaps there was something in the storage shed that I could use to move Charlie back to the lab. I didn't remember anything, but I went into the shed to check anyway. I entered cautiously, hearing a banging sound. It turned out to be the far door banging open and shut in the wind. Rosie's body lay just inside the door, alternately light and dark as the door banged. She had the same milky coating on her skin that the rabbit had had, but I didn't go over to look closely. I hastily searched the shelves, opened the utility closet, looked behind stacked boxes. I found a furniture dolly made of wooden slats with small rollers, but it would be useless in sand. I went back outside under the corrugated shed and hurried to the Toyota. There was nothing to do but try to carry Charlie across to the lab building. I might be able to manage it if he could support part of his own weight. Maybe by now he was feeling better, I thought. Maybe he was stronger. But one look at his face told me he wasn't. If anything, he appeared weaker. Shit, Charlie, what am I going to do with you? He didn't answer. I can't carry you, and David didn't leave the keys in his car, so we're out of luck. I stopped. What if David were locked out of his car? He was an engineer. He thought of contingencies like that. Even if it was unlikely to happen, David would never be caught unprepared. He'd never be flagging down cars, asking if they had a wire hanger he could borrow. No, no. David would have hidden a key, probably in one of those magnetic key boxes. I started to lie down on my back to look underneath the car, when it occurred to me that David would never get his clothes dirty just to retrieve a key. He'd hide it cleverly, but within easy reach. With that in mind, I ran my fingers along the inside of the front bumpers. Nothing. I went to the back bumper. Did the same. Nothing. I felt under the running boards on both sides of the car. Nothing. No magnetic box, no key. I couldn't believe it, so I got down and looked under the car to see if there was a brace or a strut I had somehow missed with my fingers. No, there wasn't. I felt no key. I shook my head, puzzled. The hiding place needed to be steel for the magnetic box, and it needed to be protected from the elements. That was why almost everybody hid their keys inside the car bumpers. David hadn't done that. Where else could you hide a key? I walked around the car again, looking at the smooth lines of the metal. I ran my fingers around the front grille opening and under the back license plate indentation. No key. I started to sweat. It wasn't only the tension. By now, I could definitely feel the drop in the wind. I went back to Charlie, who was still sitting on the sideboard. How you doing, Charlie? He didn't answer, just gave a little shrug. I took his headset off and put it on. I heard static and voices talking softly. It sounded like Ricky and Bobby, and it sounded like an argument. I pulled the mouthpiece near my lips and said, "Guys, speak to me." A pause. Bobby, surprised. "Jack?" "That's right." "Jack, you can't stay there. The wind's been falling steadily for the last few minutes. It's only 10 knots now." "Okay." "Jack, you've got to come back in." "I can't just yet." "Below 7 knots, the swarms can move." "Okay." Ricky. "What do you mean, okay? Jesus, Jack, are you coming in or not?" "I can't carry Charlie." "You knew that when you went out." "Uh-huh." "Jack, what the hell are you doing?"
I heard the whir of the video monitor in the corner of the shed. I looked over the roof of the car and saw the lens rotate as they zoomed in on me. The Toyota was such a big car, it almost blocked my view of the camera. And the ski rack on top made it even higher. I vaguely wondered why David had a ski rack, because he didn't ski. He always hated cold. The rack must have come with the car as standard equipment, and I swore it was so obvious. There was only one place I hadn't checked. I jumped up on the running board and looked at the roof of the car. I ran my fingers over the ski rack and along the parallel tracks bolted to the roof. My fingers touched black tape against the black rack. I pulled the tape away and saw a silver key. Jack, 9 knots. Okay. I dropped back down to the ground and climbed in the driver's seat. I put the key in the lockbox and twisted it. The box opened. Inside, I found a small yellow key. Jack, what are you doing? I hurried around to the back of the car. I fitted the yellow key in the ignition. I straddled the bike and started it up. The motor rumbled loudly under the corrugated shed. Jack! I walked the bike around the side of the car to where Charlie was sitting. That was going to be the tricky part. The bike didn't have a kickstand. I moved as close to Charlie as I could, and then tried to support him enough that he could climb onto the back seat, while I still sat on the bike and kept it upright. Fortunately, he seemed to understand what I was doing. I got him in place and told him to hold on to me. Bobby Lembeck. Jack, they're here. Where? Southside, coming toward you. Okay. I gunned the motor and pulled the passenger door shut, and I stayed exactly where I was. Jack? Ricky. What's the matter with him? He knows what the danger is. Bobby. I know. He's just sitting there. Charlie had his hands around my waist. His head was on my shoulder. I could hear his raspy breathing. I said, hold tight, Charlie. He nodded. Ricky. Jack, what are you doing? Then at my ear, in a voice just above a whisper, Charlie said,
fucking idiot.
Yes, I nodded. I waited. I could see the swarms now, coming around the building. This time, there were 9 swarms, and they headed straight for me in a V formation. Their own flocking behavior. 9 swarms, I thought. Soon, there would be 30 swarms. And then, 200. Bobby. Jack, do you see them?
I see them.
Of course I saw them. And of course, they were different from before. They were denser now, the columns thicker and more substantial. Those swarms didn't weigh 3 pounds anymore. I sensed they were closer to 10 or 20 pounds, maybe even more than that, maybe 30 pounds. They would have real weight now, and real substance. I waited. I stayed where I was. Some detached part of my brain was wondering what the formation would do when it reached me. Would they circle me? Would some of the swarms hang back and wait? What did they make of the noisy bike? Nothing. They came right for me, flattening the V into a line. Then into a kind of inverted V. I could hear the deep, vibrating hum. With so many swarms, it was much louder. The swirling columns were 20 yards away from me, then 10. Were they able to move faster now, or was it my imagination? I waited until they were almost upon me before I twisted the throttle and raced forward. I passed straight through the lead swarm into the blackness and out again, and then I was gunning for the power station door, bouncing over the desert, not daring to look back over my shoulder. It was a wild ride, and it only lasted a few seconds. As we reached the power station, I dropped the bike, put my shoulder under Charlie's arm, and staggered the final step or two to the door. The swarms were still 50 yards away from the door when I managed to turn the knob, pull, get 1 foot in the crack, and kick the door open the rest of the way. When I did that, I lost my balance, and Charlie and I more or less fell through the door onto the concrete. The door came swinging shut,
and wanged into our legs, which hung outside. I felt a sharp pain in my ankles, but worse, the door was still open, kept ajar by our legs. Through the opening, I could see the swarms approaching. I scrambled to my feet and dragged Charlie's inert body into the room. The door shut, but I knew it was a fire door and it wasn't airtight. Nanoparticles could come right in. I had to get both of us into the airlock. We wouldn't be safe until the first set of glass doors had hissed shut. Grunting and sweating, I hauled Charlie into the airlock. I got him into a sitting position, propped up against the side blowers. That cleared his feet of the glass doors, and because only one person could be in the airlock at a time, I stepped back outside, and I waited for the doors to close. But they didn't close. I looked on the side wall for some sort of button, but I didn't see anything. The lights were on inside the airlock, so it was getting power, but the doors didn't close, and I knew the swarms were fast approaching. Bobby Lembeck and May came running into the far room. I saw them through the second set of glass doors. They were waving their arms, making big gestures, apparently indicating for me to come back into the airlock. But that didn't make sense. Into my headset, I said, "I thought you had to go one at a time." They didn't have headsets and couldn't hear me. They were waving frantically. "Come in, come in." I held up two fingers questioningly. They shook their heads. They seemed to be indicating I was missing the point. At my feet, I saw the nanoparticles begin to come into the room like black steam. They were coming through the edges of the fire door. I had only 5 or 10 seconds now. I stepped back in the airlock. Bobby and May were nodding, approving. But the doors did not close. Now they were making other gestures, lifting. "You want me to lift, Charlie?" They did. I shook my head. Charlie was slumped there in a sitting position, a dead weight on the ground. I looked back at the anteroom and saw it was filling with black particles, starting to form a grayish mist in the air. The grayish mist was coming into the airlock as well. I felt the first tiny pinpricks on my skin. I looked at Bobby and May on the other side of the glass. They could see what was happening. They knew only seconds remained. They were again making gestures. "Lift Charlie up." I bent over him, got my hands under his armpits. I tried to haul him to his feet, but he didn't budge. "Charlie, for God's sake, help." Groaning, I tried again. Charlie kicked his legs and pushed with his arms, and I got him a couple of feet off the ground. Then he slid back down. "Charlie, come on, once more." I pulled up as hard as I could, and this time he helped a lot, and we got his legs back under him, and with a final heave got him standing. I kept my hands under his armpits. We were in a kind of crazy lover's clench. Charlie was wheezing. I looked back to the glass doors. The doors didn't close. The air was getting blacker all the time. I looked to May and Bobby, and they were frantic, holding up two fingers, shaking them at me. I didn't get it. "Yes, there's two of us." What was wrong with the damn doors? Finally, May bent over and very deliberately pointed with one finger of each hand to her two shoes. I saw her mouth, "Two shoes," and point to Charlie. "Yeah, so we have two shoes. He's standing on two shoes." May shook her head. She held up four fingers. "Four shoes?" The pinpricks were irritating, making it difficult to think. I felt the old confusion begin to seep over me. My brain felt sluggish. What did she mean, four shoes? It was beginning to get dark in the airlock. It was becoming harder to see May and Bobby. They were pantomiming something else, but I didn't get it. They began to feel distant to me, distant and trivial. I was without energy and without care. Two shoes, four shoes. And then I got it. I turned my back to Charlie, leaned against him, and said, "Put your hands around my neck." He did, and I grabbed his legs and lifted his feet off the floor. Instantly, the door hissed shut. That was it, I thought. The blowers began to blast down on us. The air rapidly cleared. I strained to hold Charlie up, and I managed until I saw the second set of doors unlock and slide open. May and Bobby hurried into the airlock, and I just fell down. Charlie landed on top of me. I think it was Bobby who dragged him off me, I'm not sure. From that point on, I don't remember much at all.